What's the long-term impact on the immune system of measles infection?
The best treatment to prevent complications with recurrent C. diff infection.
If people talk with their healthcare provider about their end-of-life wishes, how does that impact on medical care utilization?
And a guidance statement for screening for colorectal cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on November 8th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to start first with the measles story. This actually broke last week on Friday, and as many of our listeners already know, we record earlier in the week, so we were unable to cover this last week, but I think it's such an important issue that I really wanted to cover it, so I appreciate your flexibility on that. This was in the journal Science and also in Science Immunology. There are two papers relative to this. And just as a review, the paper highlights the fact that there are over 100,000 deaths annually from measles worldwide. They used a technique that's called VRSCAN, which is an assay that tracks antibodies to thousands of pathogen, what is called an epitope. That's the specific area that an antibody is produced against in our bodies in people's blood. They had the opportunity, and I think this was really fascinating, to study 77 unvaccinated children before and 2 months after natural measles virus infection. Well, goodness, how did that happen? They did it in the Netherlands, where there are families and communities with low vaccination rates. And they went there and said, hey, you guys, are you willing to participate in this study? And they said, sure, they would, which I think is really interesting that they would participate in a study but wouldn't vaccinate their children. It just seems like a disconnect to me, but that's just the way my brain works. They also compared that to a number of other, actually three specifically control groups, adults, children who were unvaccinated but did not seroconvert, were not exposed to the measles virus during that time, and another group. They took a look at what happens with measles virus infection, and they found out that measles virus can infect 20 to 70% of memory cells. These are cells in the immune system that are responsible for mounting an immune response when you get a second or a third or whatever exposure to an infection. And that included all the different types of memory cells, not just B cells, which are the ones that produce antibodies. And they also showed that there was a variable impact on the number of circulating antibodies that these kids had even after they convalesced from the measles infection. So the dire consequences of measles virus infection are actually quite profound, and they persist over time. They speculate that this could have a lot to do with deaths that are relative to measles, where someone might become infected, recover, but then subsequently get infected with another pathogen to which they'd previously been immune. So a very compelling argument for measles vaccines.
When someone gets a measles infection, they have lifelong immunity to measles. However, about 10 to 15% of those individuals have prolonged immunosuppression, even up to 5 years after they've had the measles. They call it immune amnesia. Now, by the way, it doesn't occur in kids that are vaccinated. They don't develop the immune suppression. It's only in those that develop the active infection.
Again, I know we both agree that this is very compelling evidence that vaccination is just so, so important.
Elizabeth, there are on a number of different levels why it's incredibly important. Again, not only to prevent the measles infection, but to prevent subsequent secondary infections that occur because of the immunosuppression that occurs with it. So thank you for picking this article.
Oh, you're welcome. Which of your two would you like to turn to?
If we're going to talk about infections, let's talk about C. diff infections. That's a GI infection, usually occurring in individuals that have been exposed to antibiotics. The C. diff predisposes not only to diarrhea, but can also cause bloodborne infections, colon perforation. When an individual has it and they're treated, about 20% of these individuals can have recurrent C. diff infection. The treatment for that lies in two possibilities. One is prolonged antibiotics, or the second is to do fecal microbiota transplantation. We're going to call it FMT, where the active ingredients of the stool are put in, the individual, either orally or through an enema, to reconstitute the GI tract. FMT is more effective than antibiotics in curing recurrent C. diff. But nobody's ever looked to see whether it actually prevents the infections. That is bloodborne, bloodstream infections, whether it changes the length of the hospital stay, or it even changes survival. So the authors in this single center study looked at 290 patients that had a recurrent C. diff infection. About 109 were treated with fetal microbiota transplantation, and 181 received antibiotics. What they discovered was those that received FMT had a much lower incidence of bloodborne infection, 23% less, had a shorter hospital stay, and more importantly, there was a 32% increase in their overall survival.
I think it's important to note, of course, that in last week's New England Journal of Medicine, a study that we did not highlight reported on the first death relative to this technique in somebody who had been diagnosed with Clostridium difficile infection. And now there's been a flurry of activity relative to safety and the assurance that we're not going to be transplanting something that's going to subsequently cause more illness.
Right, and that comes into screening individuals that provide the samples for the FMT. And so you're right, it's not without some risk, and it has to be done properly. However, when compared to antibiotic therapy, it's a much more effective therapy for recurrent, not initial C. diff, but for recurrent C. diff. And now this evidence suggests that it prevents some of the serious complications as well.
Very good. Let's turn to JAMA Network Open, a subject that's near and dear to my heart, as you're well aware, and anybody who listens to us often is also well aware. This is relative to discussions with folks who are critically ill about end-of-life issues, and what does that do with regard to healthcare utilization? This was a retrospective study that looked at a number of patients over the course of a year using an insurance claims database to assess whether they had any kind of an advanced care planning billing code as part of all of their spectrum of care during that time period or not. In this case, they looked at over 18,000 seriously ill patients. They said, is there a billed advanced care planning encounter that was associated with that? This is where the number gets to be very small, at least as far as I'm concerned. From that 18,000 plus, they called 864 who did have such an advanced care planning encounter. And then they correlated that with, well, what happened with regard to the medical care that they subsequently utilized. So that was only 4.7% of the sample. I'd like to see a whole lot more robust numbers than this. The upshot of the whole thing was that patients who had billed advanced care planning encounters were more likely than those to receive hospice services, but they were also more likely to be hospitalized and in ICUs. They were less likely to receive things like chemotherapy at the end of life. And if we take a look at the total cost, it really is not a big cost savings with regard to saying, hey, what do you want at the end of life?
No, in fact, the individuals that had advanced care planning actually had a higher hospital bill than those that didn't. Elizabeth, you know, I think this is a nice first attempt to show what advanced care planning, but as you demonstrate, I think it's not a very good study for a number of reasons. One is only 5% of patients in this study had advanced care planning billing. And we know that more than 1 in 20 individuals talk to their physicians about the advanced care. So I think this underrepresents, and that's because the advanced care billing's only been available since January 2016. The other thing, it doesn't tell us how effective that advanced care was. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done in terms of studies to define, but I do want to give the authors credit because we assume that advanced care planning reduces hospitalization and is beneficial, but unless we study it, we really won't know.
And there's two other places where I would like to see more information. They do admit that one of the confounding variables could have been that there was a higher severity of illness among those folks who had the advanced care planning. There needs to be some kind of an accounting of that. And then the other thing I would really like to see is patient satisfaction. Were patients happier when they had that kind of an encounter versus not?
Previous studies, not this one, have suggested that's the case. Now, whether that delivers better care in the end is still undefined. So again, more to come.
Indeed. Finally, let's turn to the American College of Physicians recommendations regarding screening for colorectal cancer, also published in Annals of Internal Medicine.
This is called a guidance statement. Well, what is that, or how does that differ? What happens is there are a number of different guidelines from different organizations, and they disagree on the age to start colorectal cancer screening and when to stop the screening, how often the screening should take place, and the recommended screening method. What the American College of Physicians decided to do was look at all the different guidelines and decide, based upon what we know and all the information available, what should we recommend? That's important because colorectal cancer is actually the second leading cause of cancer-related death in both men and women in the United States. The first guidance statement is that clinicians should screen for colorectal cancer in average risk adults between the ages of 50 and 75 years. Now, by the way, if you have a history of colorectal cancer, or if you have a history of polyps or inflammatory bowel disease, you're high risk, so these recommendations don't apply to you. The second recommendation is clinicians should select the screening test with the patient on the basis of a discussion of the benefits, harms, risk, and cost, and the availability to the patient as well. The three things they'd recommend are, if the person wants to have colonoscopy, that should be done every 10 years. If that's not available, but they do testing of the stool, then that should be done every 2 years, either with fecal immunochemical testing called FIT or high-sensitivity guaiac-based fecal occult blood testing. And then finally, if sigmoidoscopy is what's used, that should be done every 10 years with FIT every 2 years. The patient can decide which they prefer. And then finally, clinicians should discontinue screening for colorectal cancer in average risk patients over 75 years of age or in adults that have a life expectancy less than 10 years.
A very, very important thing. And of course, the fecal occult blood testing is just so easy.
Yes. Some individuals say, well, I'd prefer to have that. And especially individuals, for example, that in remote areas that may not have access to colonoscopy or sigmoidoscopy.
One more guidance I think would have been really great would have been for clinicians in how to frame the conversation when it comes to, hey, you've kind of aged out of having cancer screening, because patients can respond to that in a fairly negative way.
I think your point's well taken. In fact, they do mention in the article that once you develop the polyps, it takes about 10 years before the polyp turns into cancer. So it's a slow progression, and that's why screening is so important. But if you're 75 years of age, the average lifespan for a man is about 10 years, and the average lifespan for a woman is about 12 years. And so you're less likely to die of colorectal cancer than you are of some other competing cause, like a stroke or coronary artery disease.
On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.